Hello, and welcome to the AK-47 podcast. My name is Kristen Godsey, and today I am going to read a very interesting piece, which was a biographical article about Alexandra Kollontai, which appeared in 1930, written by a woman who herself is a kind of interesting character. But before I begin reading this article, I'd like to share some news, which is that Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism just got under contract for a Hebrew edition. So with that new translation, I'm now up to 15 foreign language translations for the book, which is pretty remarkable for a little volume about women and sex and socialism. I am constantly surprised at how this book has continued to find an audience. I am just back from Scotland, where I attended the British Association of Slavonic and East European Studies and gave a paper, not on Kollontai, but on typewriters, which is something that I happen to be writing about right now. And it was really interesting to be in Glasgow and hear papers. And obviously, you know, much of the discussions revolved around the ongoing war in Ukraine. And now that it's April, I'm looking down the end of a semester, which is great news because I think it means I'll be able to record more podcasts. I've been very busy, and I've, as I often do at this time of the year, let the podcast slide by. So I'm back, and thank you so much for sticking with me. So let me tell you a little bit about this article that I am going to read to you today. So it was written by a woman named Catherine Anthony, who lived between 1877 and 1965. She was a biographer, and she wrote some pretty best-selling books about Catherine the Great and Queen Elizabeth. But what's particularly interesting about Catherine Anthony is that she was openly a lesbian, and she lived with her life partner, Elizabeth Irwin, who was the founder of the Little Red School House in New York. And she had this fascination, Anthony did, about sort of women in power. And she wrote this article, which is called Alexandra Kollontai, the World's One Woman Ambassador, in 1930 for a magazine called the North American Review, which existed between 1821 and 1940. This was an American periodical that, you know, sort of had interest stories about different people. And this article is a sort of feature. It's a little like kind of mini biography of Kollontai by this American woman who I imagine was quite fascinated by Kollontai and her role as, at the time, the world's one woman ambassador. So the language is a little archaic. You'll see when I start reading it, but I do think it's really fascinating to get the American perspective, but also this sort of uniquely queer American perspective on Kollontai as an international figure. So I'm going to go ahead and read probably part one of this today, and then I'll finish it in part two in the next episode, because it's a little on the longer side. But it's beautifully written, and I think it gives a really wonderful sense of Kollontai as a person, as seen, of course, by an American woman. All right, so this is from 1930, Alexandra Kollontai, the World's One Woman Ambassador, by Catherine Anthony. Alexandra Kollontai remembers that as a child, she was conscious of an unusual destiny. The self-assurance manifested thus early has carried through until today. She occupies a unique position in the world. As plenipotentiary representative of the USSR to Norway, she is the only woman diplomat in international politics. Coming from the far north of Russia, St. Petersburg and Finland are her background, she is not a Muscovite, but a European Russian, and that means, among other things, that she is temperamentally inclined to internationalism. Her skill as a diplomat rests partly on this fact. Among the wide, tree-planted Drammensveien of Oslo stands a row of stately villas which house the envoys of foreign countries in Norway. A brass shield on one of them proclaims in Russian lettering with the name of the Soviet Republic. Within, in a set of busy offices with typewriters clicking, messengers scurrying, telephones ringing, a complicated business is carried on under the direction of a woman executive. As you enter her office, a pair of large gray eyes, thoughtful to the point of sadness, is raised to greet you. But a quick smile assures you that the owner has no need of sympathy. You present your business, whatever it is that brought you, and you feel at once in contact with an overflowing energy. In the spacious, quiet office, secretaries come and go, speaking several languages. What people these Russians are! Alexandra Kollontai herself speaks 11, bringing more letters and documents to the already heaped-up desk. Presently, the telephone rings, and Her Excellency interrupts her conversation with you, in whatever language that may happen to have been conducted, to converse in fluent Norwegian. There is something electric and modern about her, impossible to define, something swift and efficient in keeping with our post-war age. "I can telephone to my son from this desk," she says, pointing to the instrument. He is, as you learn in passing, an engineer at work on a hydroelectric enterprise in the mountains of Sweden. Alexandra Kollontai's childish conviction of being chosen may have been partly due to the fact that she was the offspring of a romantic union, subsequently legalized. It was probably also an awareness of her unusual powers. She was never sent to school, and thereby hangs a tale of irony. Her mother, who was a conservative parent, was afraid of the effect of a public school on her daughter, especially as Alexandra was already given too much to independence. So she employed a governess who successfully prepared the student at home for her university entrance exams, but who also planted in her growing mind the seeds of revolution. The governess, whose name was Marie Stachkova, and whose memory is honored by her pupil to this day, was a member of the intellectual revolutionary movement of the 80s. That's the 1880s. She gave young Alexandra an interest that prepared the way for the future ardent Marxian. From the very beginning, Alexandra Kollontai was that rare thing in Russia, a feminist. Although she looks scornfully upon bourgeois women's rights, no one has spoken, written, or striven more industriously than she has to win place and recognition for her sex as such. The work that she has done for women in Russia is really phenomenal. And although she gives due credit to Lenin, Trotsky, and Sverdlov for their assistance, it is obvious from the nature of the circumstances that she has done it almost entirely alone. Her Marxian comrades were slow to admit the working woman into the working class, and it was mainly the persistence of the educational campaign carried on by Kollontai that eventually led them to it. She formed the first Russian working women's club in St. Petersburg in 1907. Several of the charter members of which are now in prominent and responsible government positions. From the Working Women's Club sprang working women's journals, women's trade unions, international affiliations. Through it all, the tireless organizer flew back and forth like a shuttle, finding its intricate but steady way through the pattern of a newer and a better life for women. She finally brought it so far that both branches of her party, Menshevik and Bolshevik, seriously took up the women question in their programs. This seemed to her, says Kollontai, almost like a personal honor, which it undoubtedly was. Alexandra Kollontai always had a tendency towards the left. When the Bolshevik Party declared against the war in 1915, she cast her lot with them. When the new economic policy was in turn adopted by the same party, she became a leader of the workers' opposition. The speech which she made at that Soviet Congress can no longer be circulated in Russia, and for reasons that are apparent. Its cogent, cutting criticism of the new policy and its sponsors, and its moving eloquence on behalf of the workers, is too dangerously effective. What must have been the feelings of Lenin when she turned to him as her last hope of the Russian working class? Ilyich will ponder. Think over, listen to us, she said, speaking for the rank and file, and then we'll decide to turn the party rudder towards the opposition. Ilyich will be with us yet. To him, as to this pleader for the least of the Russians, the ultimate decision must have been a deadly blow. They bowed to it, but for Kollontai, it made exile welcome, and for Lenin, it meant... But let us not read tragedy into that heroic life. And I'm just going to pause here for a second and note that Catherine Anthony is suggesting here that Lenin was actually on Kollontai's side with the workers' opposition, but he was obviously not. So she's sort of representing the historical situation a little differently than it actually occurred. And I don't know if that's a decision on her part to obfuscate the truth because Lenin was by this time dead, or if this is what Kollontai told her, or if this is just, you know, ignorance and she's trying to fill in some gaps because, of course, this is 1930 and Stalin is solidly in charge and she may not have as much information. All right, so back to the article. Instead of going to a university, as she was prepared to do at the age of 16, Alexandra Kollontai was married early. So much her parents affected, though she refused to take the kind of husband they wished to provide for her. She married her own choice, a young cousin, an engineer, and had a son by him. But marriage and maternity played small part in her life. She continued to read and study, chiefly in the field of economics, and attached herself to secret groups of the like-minded. Her young husband and kinsmen had no part in these enthusiasms. Beyond his name, she took nothing from him into her future life. Kollontai herself says that no man who ever stood close to her influenced her point of view. On the contrary, she asseverates, mine was always the ruling one. Finally, she left her home, husband and child, to go to Zurich and study. Zurich was the Mecca of the rebellious in those days, and this newest émigré to be added to the colony was the focus of all the discords of her time. The revolt of a small nation, the wrath of the downtrodden workers, the rising of women against slavery, the struggle of the ignorant for enlightenment, of the oppressed for freedom, of the stifled for self-expression, all flared up at once in the breast of this pilgrim. But the blue and white city with its placid lake and sparkling air must have had a calming effect on the tumult within her, for she studied to good purpose, acquiring method, learning, and the power of prolonged industry. For 3 years, she remained there studying, though at last she left without her doctor's degree. All the training she had gained during this sojourn was placed henceforth at the service of the Socialist Party, which she officially joined on her return to Russia. All right, so I'm going to stop reading this essay here. I do think it's very interesting the way that Catherine Anthony is sort of portraying Kollontai as this incredibly heroic woman, as a very independent woman who is not does not allow herself to be swayed by men's opinions and in fact sways those opinions, but is also very careful to paint her as a mother, to mention that she has a son and that she can call her son at any time and that she would obviously wish to. Catherine Anthony and her life partner, Elizabeth Irwin, actually raised several adopted children together in their lives. And you can clearly see here that Catherine Anthony is quite taken by Kollontai and by the story of Kollontai, by the life of Kollontai, and is imagining this alternative world where independent women like herself, Catherine Anthony, could actually rise to these very high positions in political power through the creation of a worker state, through socialism. Now, I don't know a whole lot about Anthony. I'm not 100% sure about her personal politics, but it is quite fascinating, I think, that she chose Kollontai as a subject. And as we'll see in the next episode, she is very laudatory of Kollontai as a person and as a role model to other women. Even as a she calls her a feminist, even though she admits that Kollontai is hostile to quote unquote bourgeois women's activism. So that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I actually don't often end these podcasts with a request, but I'm going to do so today because we are getting close to the publication date for my next book, Everyday Utopia, What 2,000 Years of Wild Experiments Can Teach Us About the Good Life, which in fact does feature bits and pieces about Kollontai and her life. Now, this is a trade book, which is a little scary. It's very different from an academic book. And my publisher is putting a little pressure on me to try to generate some kind of pre-orders. Pre-orders are apparently very important when you have a book that's coming out with a trade press because it sort of creates buzz and, I don't know, makes the algorithm put your book higher up in people's searches, or I don't even pretend to understand how all of this works. But if you have been a fan of the podcast, if you have been listening, or even if you're new and you want to support the work that I've been doing since January of 2019 for the last 4 years, I don't have a Patreon. I don't have, a coffee thing, or I don't know, all these websites where you're supposed to, you know, get support from people. So I've just been doing it on my own, you know, with the occasional help of my daughter. But if you want to support the podcast, I would be extremely grateful if you could pre-order the book on the platform of your choice, or even better, in your local independent bookstore. That would even be better to support local businesses. But if you, want to just get the word out there, the book is called Everyday Utopia. It comes out on May 16th, and you know, I'm hoping that it will touch a lot of people outside of the normal circles of leftists that I reach. You know, I really do think Kollontai's message and the message of many millennia's worth of utopian thinkers can help us change the world, can bring a lot of meaning and purpose to people who feel isolated and despairing because of the climate crisis and the miserable state of late stage capitalism. So I will leave a couple of links in the show notes. If you're so inclined, please do put in a pre-order and spread the word. Anyway, until next time, please keep up the good fight.